Several years ago, a priest at a nearby parish had begun an intensive, demanding confirmation program for teenagers. The program involved mandatory classes twice a month, regular homework, service projects, and meetings with mentors. This was not your run-them-through-the-mill, get-them-done confirmation program. It was a 9-month intentional process that called a great deal from the youth that were being asked to confirm the faith that they had been welcomed into, and often at a very early age. And the program was met with enthusiasm by many of the parents and teenagers of the parish. But roughly halfway through the process, one parent came to meet with the priest because of concerns that she had about her daughter's involvement with the confirmation program. After some discussion, the parent explained that she knew that the classes were mandatory, but her daughter would have to miss some of them because they fell on the same nights. Some of them fell on the same nights that her daughter had soccer practices, and if she missed those practices, the coach refused to play her in the games. It was unfortunate, but unavoidable. Now, maybe this priest had had one too many meetings that day. Or possibly this was just his day for telling the truth. But this was his response. He said, "I know that soccer is important to your daughter, but I want you to think ahead several years when she has moved out of your house, has a job, maybe a family, and something terrible happens which shakes her world. None of us ever wishes for that, but these things happen to all of us. Test us in ways we never expect. So my question for you is this. When that inevitable, earth-shattering event happens, will soccer be there to save her?" The story of the salvific effects of soccer is somewhat humorous, as well as harsh. But I believe it can serve as an entrance into a question that is asked by our sacred texts this morning, namely, how do we remember who we are? How do we remember who we are? It's a question at the heart of our life of faith and is foundational for us in the year 2010. In this age of Twitter and Facebook, of self-narration in this postmodern world. This question is foundational even amidst the much speculated collapse of master narratives that have shaped societies for centuries. Because, as this priest offered in a way, if you don't know your story, in the midst of struggle, of testing in the wilderness, how will you have any idea who you are? How will you live not only in the world as we wish it to be, but in the world also as it really is? This question, of course, is as old as they come. We find it this morning in one of our seminal texts from Deuteronomy. Remember that this section from Deuteronomy is the farewell address that Moses gives to the people of the covenant. And to this day, it serves as a cultural and religious touchstone. In it, Moses is instilling the story into the people of Israel so that they will have an answer to give about who they are, about why they live. And the story, the response, begins. "My ancestor was a wandering Aramean." Now, of course, many generations had passed from Jacob's semi-nomadic life, but for each faithful person of Israel, he was their father, their ancestor. This was their story. In times of testing and temptation, this was how they remembered who and whose they were. I was reminded recently that one of the weaknesses of our lectionary cycle, the set of scriptural readings that many Christian denominations use every week, is that on Sundays we hop around the Gospels and aren't able to read straight through. And often there is a great deal to be learned from the context of the stories that we encounter. So, some context. A few months ago, at the start of Advent, we read the beginning of the third chapter of Luke about John the Baptist at the River Jordan preparing the way of the Lord. Then, several weeks ago, for the first Sunday after the Epiphany, we continued in the third chapter with the baptism of Jesus, ending with God's proclamation that you are my Son, the Beloved. With you I am well pleased. And today, the first Sunday of Lent, we pick up this narrative again, thankfully after setting aside the genealogy of Jesus. That takes a while. Now, I mention this because leading up to this passage is the proclamation of who Jesus is. And after this passage, Jesus leaves the wilderness to do what he has been called to do. And so this morning, we find ourselves in an in-between liminal space, the kind of space that many here today might actually be living in, a wilderness kind of space, an already but not yet kind of space, the kind of space that lends itself to questions like, who am I? What does it mean to be who I am? What in the world am I to be doing? These are the very questions that Jesus faced during his own time in the wilderness. They came after he had spent 40 long days in the arid, unforgiving wilderness, fasting, preparing himself for what was to come. And just as his time has come to a close, and he is, as our text reads, famished, the temptation, the testing begins. Now, this part of the story might seem familiar. As far as I've known, the tests of life often come when we are famished. Rarely do they come when we are at full strength and awareness. They often present themselves when we are feeling weakened, vulnerable, spent. Enter, stage right, the tempter. In Hebrew, Satan, or the adversary. The evil that in Luke's gospel will serve as the locus of the personal will against God. And in this story, what will serve as one that tests Jesus, carefully, almost imperceptibly trying to shift Jesus' will, bending it away from God. And the shape that this confrontation takes is what is commonly known as the three temptations. But since the word temptation comes with its own baggage, it might be helpful to look at the biblical Greek, because in this case, it gives us more purchase. Because the word translated as tempted in the Greek is perizomenos, which has to do with testing. It is the same sense of testing that one does with silver, to find out what it is made of. This is what the tempter was attempting to do with Jesus, trying to get Jesus to prove himself in a false way, to question his identity, that he might become something that he was not to be. Which I can say, as one who has spent his share of time in the wilderness, is often the case. When you're tired, when you're vulnerable, when you are compromised, finding your way, your sense of self in the wilderness is treacherous. And often the tests that come your way seem plausible enough. I mean, if they were obvious, they wouldn't be tests. Each of the tests that Jesus faces on the surface is something we might expect of him. And yet each of these tests are attempts to draw Jesus away from his primary relationship with God, to isolate him on his own, to his own plausibly worthwhile ends. The first test, to turn stones into bread. Now remember, he is famished. And isn't he the one that will feed 5,000 with just a few loaves? Yet Jesus responds that doing so would negate humanity's primary dependence on God. Second, to worship the adversary and in the process rule over the kingdoms of the world. Jesus could make right the wrongs of this world. And don't we believe him to be the king of the kingdom, to whom every knee shall bend? But Jesus answers that worship belongs to God alone, that service to self inevitably leads away from God. And finally, and remember this when you come to these texts, because the tempter knows Scripture too. This from the psalm this morning. Jesus is tempted to test God to see if his well-being matters. Remember this in a few weeks. Jesus could have assured his physical safety and have never come to harm. And wouldn't we trust the angels to protect he whom they proclaimed at his birth? Yet Jesus replies that our relationship with God does not rely on tests to know of God's ultimate love and care for us. Now it is essential to remember that each of Jesus' responses that he gives come directly from the foundational text of the book of Deuteronomy, from the passages that are found earlier than our reading we heard this morning. Every time that Jesus is pulled into defining himself by himself in isolation from relationship with God, every time to his own end, Jesus turns to the primary story to remember who and whose he is. Friends, this is the fallacy, the lie that the tempter always tries to seduce us with, that we can do this on our own. And that in this life, that can be a long loneliness, we can depend only upon ourselves, that our sustenance, our strength, our security, all come from our ability alone. This is a lie intrinsic to our world and can be found throughout cultures, classes, and countries. I mean, has anyone else had the experience of sacrificing and giving oneself to a prize, a promotion, a degree, a relationship, in order to gain status, power, or protection, only to find that it didn't, in fact, give you the nourishment, possibility, or safety that it promised? This is why we come to this story today, again, like every year, as we take time to approach the central mystery of our faith. And by doing just this, by reading the sacred word daily, by renewing our prayer, by being present to those in need, we come closer to the essential questions about who we are. In Lent, we voluntarily come closer to the wilderness if we are already not there. Not to wound or isolate ourselves, God knows that there is enough opportunity for that around us. No, we come to Lent. We come to the wilderness. We come to this morning to set time aside so that we as a body can enter this intentional liminal space and once again live into our story. The story that allows us to remember who and whose we are.